עוד פעם אני אדבר באנגלית. אם יש מישהו שרוצה תרגום, שטמציון. אבל עוד פעם, I'll try and make the English even simpler if I can, until it completely disappears. The talk tonight is about meditation and transformation. Don't have to translate that word because it's the same in Hebrew. We all came to this meditation course for very different reasons, and many of us came from very ordinary reasons. We heard about it and we're curious. We've got a headache, chronic headaches, and we want to know how to deal with chronic problem, mind-body problem. We feel stress and we think meditation might help. Or we feel life is crazy and we want to just slow down a little bit. And these are all really legitimate reasons. And to some extent, what we do here can answer those reasons. And we may already have felt it, that something about the simplicity of not needing to, not having to, not being forced into a framework or a certain kind of behavior because we have to keep being ourselves in society, or because we have to keep acting in society, or because we have to keep playing the big game out there. There is a sense that we stopped playing the game. We stepped out of it. And we just stopped and we breathed. And in that simplicity, there is a healing and there is a sense of coming home. And there is, despite all the difficulties we may be facing, a quiet joy and peace in just the clarity and simplicity of breathing in and out, of sitting, of walking, of knowing. And many of us will go home and feel we have taken some of that home with us, hopefully bringing a little bit more peace to ourselves and others who, it seems, in the world around really need it. So we may in general feel more relaxed from being here and go home feeling a little more peace. But it would be a shame if that was all there was to it. Now, it's interesting that the Transcendental Meditation, TM, movement has produced a lot of scientific studies showing the benefits of TM. And I've read some of them and looked at them. And it's interesting that in none of this research has there ever been any distinction made between relaxation and meditation. In other words, relaxation will also do to you many of the things, do to us, many of the things which we experience from just stopping, slowing down, and so on. If we look at the heart rate and the brain waves we do deep relaxation after yoga, we lie down on the ground, we relax deeply, and many of these things happen to us then too. So in that sense, to find some quiet in us doesn't actually need the meditation that we're doing. So there has to be something else. The TM, Transcendental Meditation Movement, talk about recharging batteries, that that's why we do TM, we recharge the batteries. And I was wondering, and I was thinking about this, if you ask a monk that's been in a monastery for 30 years, and you say to him, you ask him, what are you doing all this time? And he says, I'm recharging my battery. Something's missing. And actually, you know, when I think about it, all the meditation that I've done in my life, actually, if all I'm doing is recharging my batteries, a long time ago I would have burst from overcharging with a loud bang. And actually it's not really true, because if we look carefully at what happens here when we are quiet, sitting in our place, breathing, it's not necessarily relaxation. We may be boiling, and on the outside everything looks calm. You see 100 people all quiet with their eyes closed, and there could be 100 volcanoes. And a bit like the image of the swan, that on the surface, so quiet and smooth and floating, and then if you go underneath the water, it's going like this, just to keep stable. And so we may be a bit like that, you know, we're like going like this, and in order to be like that. So Yonatan last night touched on the importance of to our life of having some connection with suffering, with the pain of existence, and a way out of it. And so I really want to address this a bit more now, because it may not be clear how this is done, and if it can be done, and some examples of this. So how do we actually let go of suffering? How do we enter a path of transformation? How can we see that what we're doing here may be something that has the power of transforming us, of making change in our life, of making something move in us, so that when we go back into, we are more gentle with it and with ourselves. And what is it that we need to do for that? The first thing I think is that here, in a way, we're not in a world of tricks, and we're not in the world of fast, instant coffee solutions. If it was as simple as sitting, chanting Om, or listening to music, we would all be doing it. It's not that simple. And there's something that is transforming in the watching of things as they happen, in the truth itself of things that happen, not in tricks, not in manipulation, not in even designing a kind of framework called a retreat and then stepping inside it, like making a circle and stepping in the circle, not even that. Because these things can all work in certain ways, but to really transform ourselves, to really make a difference, the truth can do it, but not games we play with ourselves. And so we're trying in some way in this path to avoid the tricks, the ziyuf, the non-authentic way. And instead, we're looking at the truth. And the truth is the messages that we're receiving all the time. The truth doesn't come from anywhere else. It's the messages that we're receiving. And what do we do with them? And how do we work with them? And what are they? So, basically, we see ourselves in the mirror. Now, many of you may say when you hear this, well, I always look at myself in the mirror. I'm tired of looking at my... I'm full of my thoughts, and I'm full of my... I'm busy with myself. I look at myself in the mirror all the time. But one has to ask whether that's really true. Because I feel that most of our life, we are being ourselves but not seeing ourselves. We are being Stephen or being Iran or being Simi or being John and Harry, acting it, acting ourselves, but not really seeing who the actor is, not out being able to take that distance, to take the one step back and say, who is it that's acting Stephen in the world? And a lot of our understanding here comes from getting out of a kind of automatic mode, you know, automatic car which is driving itself. That a lot of what we're doing is actually exploring the automatic, which is the automatically being Stephen and acting in the world, and bringing it into consciousness. And so the mirror is actually deeper and clearer. And we might find that when we do this, we don't actually look at ourselves in the mirror that much in our ordinary life. We just may not be doing it. We think a lot about perhaps ourselves, or about what to do, or what we need to do, or what we don't like, or what we do like, or but it's not helping us look in the mirror. So one of the things we're doing is taking an automatic world, including the body and the breath and the moments that happen, and bringing it into consciousness. And someone asked me today, is it important if I do this and scratch my head? Now in this retreat, I'm knowing I'm doing it. That's all. That's the whole thing. That's what we're doing here. I meant to know when I scratch myself. And the answer, in a funny way, is yes. It seems strange to say that, but yes. Because if we know ourselves, if I know my hand when it goes like this, I also know my body when it's telling me things. I also know the stress in my body when it's telling me I am in stress. I can also begin to hear the calls and the cries for help from my body or other people's bodies or other... I can begin to know the automatic world and kind of open it up. As much as I can feel my hand when it moves, I can feel the tree, I can feel the cat walking along the path, I can feel the struggle of the fly when it drops into the cup of tea and doesn't want to be there. And it's as if that you can't necessarily choose what to see, but you can bring a sensitivity and a contact to a greater and greater territory or area of your life. And that is what it means looking in the mirror, because looking in the mirror isn't just taking one section and saying, okay, if I'm a good philosopher, I can think things out about life, then I'm looking at myself in the mirror. But we forget that that's a cultural issue, and we're looking at a very small slice of our being, which we've made a very, very important slice. We've made it very big. So we need to actually meet ourselves more deeply if we want to change, if we want to transform. And when we do give ourselves this distance, a little bit of distance, we stand back and we give some space, and this is what we're doing here. We're giving space, even though it's sometimes quite boring and seems pointless and we don't quite know why we're doing it, but if we just hang in there, we find we give space and things do come up. And slowly but steadily things arrive. And usually what arrives is, or often is, burdens and patterns of thinking and things that disturb us or annoy us, or things about ourselves we don't like, or things about somebody else that we don't like, or boredom, or some of the hindrances that Simi talked about. And we say, well, is that what it, I mean, do I have to see my own soap opera? Do I have to go through my soap opera? Is that what I'm forced to do? We may question whether this thing is working and so on. But indeed, when we have a clear mind and we begin to see our own soap, our own stories, our own movie, that's the beginning of having a handle on who we are and being able to be, to understand ourselves, to atzmeinu, to know ourselves. First we see the soap, first we see the drama we're playing out about ourselves. That's what comes up. It's true. In the tradition, the areas which we pay attention to are called the four foundations of mindfulness. And that's in, some of you may know, the Satipatthana Sutta. It's an ancient text, which is one of the texts which guides this retreat. It's important you should know that it does. The texts exist. They're guiding what we're doing here. It's a very ancient tradition, thankfully. It wasn't invented yesterday in California. We're following a weight of experience which I think gives us all some support. In this sutta, in this text, the first of the four foundations is the body, including the breath, the experience of the bodiness of the body, the quality of being in a body, embodied, if you like, in the body. And that's where we are in our practice here, and mostly that's where we are and what we've been doing. But already there, we may, if we look carefully, we may see the seeds of transformation, because being in the body with all its complications and issues and so on, being aware, bringing the awareness down from the thinking mind into the body, is not just helping us to be settled and steady and some calmness, although that's there as well and that's very, very valuable, but already we may be learning things about ourselves and looking at ourselves in the mirror through the body. The mind looking at the body is like the body becomes the mirror. Through the body we see ourselves. And many of you have said it already, have shared insights, either in the groups or in the hall. For example, the issue of control. The issue of, well, when I look at my breath, what's controlling what? Am I in control of what goes on in my body? Am I in control of what passes through the mind? So it's a big question. It's not an easy question. It's a koan. In other words, a question that the only way that we can really relate to this is to drop it inside and live with it, this question. Because it doesn't have an answer that you can... the answer is the living of the question. Who is in control? What is in control? Is the breath controlling me? Am I controlling the breath? Is my body controlling me? Am I controlling my body? What is automatic? What is not automatic? When I open the automatic and I look at it, then surely I'm back in control again of something that previously was, before, was automatic. Now I see it, like the breath, so they're no longer automatic, or is it? I mean, that's an example. We learn something about the stresses and the strains. And I was talking about how we build in ourselves during our life our history, and it's in the body. It's in the body and in the mind and in the spirit. But it's in the body too. So we feel the stresses or the tensions, or we feel the tightness, or we feel the contraction in the stomach, or we feel tightness here, that the breath doesn't flow free, or we feel things, and these carry messages. And if we look carefully, they tell us about ourselves. They tell us this stress is because of fear. We don't need to solve the problem of fear, but we need in a way to begin to look and see where are things, what's going on in us. And the body is a good place for this. One of the areas that many of us are experiencing, shall we say, a focus, an interest, is pain. Is just the fact of pain. And if you think how much of our life we spend avoiding pain, dealing with it, preventing it, running away from it, and being very, very occupied with not being in pain in one way or another, then suddenly developing a new relationship with pain can become a really important tool for our transformation. And we've been practicing it. A sense, for example, of the ability to stop being selective, to stop choosing the nice, to say, okay, pain is a legitimate experience that I am feeling right now, along with all the other things, and I'm going to turn towards the pain, and I'm going to be in relationship to it. I'm going to collect it in my awareness. I'm going to see it. I'm going to see where it goes, what it's doing. I'm going to look and see how I am with it. In other words, am I a victim? Am I just a sufferer? Am I continuing the pattern of I hate pain? And maybe the pain is something there because I hate it, so it's more painful. Because I want to get rid of it, maybe that's creating it. I mean, many issues around pain that many of us are already learning and experiencing in these 2 or 3 days together, and have been saying it in the groups and so on. And I was talking to a famous, or quite a well-known, Israeli pain specialist a little while back, who was treating people with chronic pain. And he actually came to a weekend that I taught in the north. And at the end of it, we just sat down, and he said, you know, I'm doing similar kinds of things to what you're doing, and I've been doing it for some time, and these are the ways I help people to get out of chronic pain. For example, to turn towards the pain and to observe it, to see it, to melt it, to play with it, to feel it's here and now it's here and now it's changing and now it's this, to create interest in it. I ask my patients to be with the pain, not to keep running away from it. And I ask my patients sometimes also to practice being in another place altogether. If it hurts here, just pay attention to your hands. Be in the world of no pain. Know that the world of no pain is as important as the world of pain. You know, that's no preference, in other words. Not the habit of avoiding pain and wanting pleasure. No preference. Here's no pain, here's pain. Now no pain, now pain. Two together. The hands, no pain, the back pain. I'll be here 10 minutes, I'll be here 10 minutes. So this kind of way of learning is about learning ourselves. It's learning about ourselves, but it is learning. And we do take this kind of learning out into the world after the retreat, and it can help us in our relationship to difficulty. If we relate differently to physical pain, we can also relate differently to emotional pain, or any kind of pain. So there's a learning that goes on here, which is the transformation. So I want to talk a little bit about emotions, because emotions are perhaps the some of the strongest baggage that we carry, the strongest load that many of us carry. They are very powerful, and emotions are part of what the second foundation of mindfulness, the liking, the not liking, the wanting, the not wanting. And when that's very strong, that becomes anger, aversion, against, or having, wanting, desiring, needing, and then losing, pain, of loss, of gain. The strength of emotions, they're very powerful, and they're based on I want, I don't want, I'm protecting, I'm protecting myself, so I have fear or anger. These kind of powerful forces in us, and they are very intense, and they're very damaging. And don't need to tell you, anybody here, how destructive emotions can be to people, to countries, to civilizations. You know, I mean, never mind here what's going on here, but if we think about America killing 3 million Vietnamese because they were afraid that maybe communism might, from Vietnam, the Vietnamese peasants might hurt America. And they were insecure. They really said, you know, if we don't do something, we will be overwhelmed by communism that starts in the peasants in the jungles of North Vietnam. They will overwhelm. I mean, it's a madness if you think about it. But if you feel the emotions of that period of America, this fear of communism, you know, the other, it's emotion, it's fear, it's a national insecurity that sweeps over the psyche of a whole nation, and is in the newspapers every morning. And we know what's going on in this part of the world with the psyche, the emotional. Collective emotion. So and emotion can also, in a subtle way, block our spiritual development. We can be so full of resistance. We can be full of anger that's really deep down, and it just stops us from developing. We don't solve the anger. It's there, and it makes us not be able to do things for ourselves, or it just subtly stops us at every turn. The anger, the resistance, the no, this is no good, this is no good, this won't work, and this is no good, and I don't like that, and I don't like that. And when you come to spiritual practice, no, this teacher, no, this one, no, this is no good, they're all, you know, etc. Resistance, or I can't sit, and I can't meditate, I can't do anything for myself, it's not working for me, nothing's working, etc. These are emotional places that once we can heal this emotion, can let go, it can give a big jump to our spiritual life. So all kinds of levels, and our relationships with others, of course, and the pain that generates by emotions that are out of control, and the kind of crazy emotional circles that get inside families and inside relationships and so on, we just, you know, everyone knows them. So it's really, if we can even touch the power of emotions, then there's already a power for our transformation. In dealing with emotions, again, the mindfulness or the awareness that we have, the ability to step back and see, is our main tool. Our ability to just step one step back and being able to not be sucked totally into the emotion is a key first step to being able to deal with emotion. And the way we learn that is simply sitting on the cushion and breathing and knowing that we are here with the breath and body. It's a sense of steady knowing, mindfulness or awareness, tsumat lev, being able to attend, is our main tool. Because when an emotion comes with all its power, we have the power to attend to it.
What is attend?
Tsumat lev, to give it attention. The tet tsumat lev. Yeah. So we have the power, we have the power to be able to hold it in our attentions. That's already a big thing. Anger comes up, for example. It's a big power. It's coming, really just coming up. We feel someone does something or says something to us, and it's fast and strong. But if we have the power to say, yeah, I can see the anger rising in me, we are already bigger than the anger. And the anger therefore cannot be overwhelmed, flood over us. We're already bigger. We are containing the anger. And that's a very crucial step. Because once we can contain lachil, the anger, then other things can follow. So if it happens here in our sitting, in our practice, it's a very good thing to practice. If anger comes up, if fear comes up, if sadness comes up, if loss comes up, if joy comes up, if ecstasy comes up, still, our power to be able to contain it, to see it, to let it flower, as Krishnamurti says, let the emotions flower, but see it. And that's the way that we can build a new relationship with anger. That's the way of transformation, with anger or any other emotion. So the first thing is to be able to see it. I remember when my children were very small, someone brought a book from California, actually, and it had pictures of the different emotions, and it gave them a name. And the anger was called red anger, and the something else. Every emotion had a name, and it had a kind of little atzaga, little play of, in a tsiurim, of what it was like. And I thought, oh, it's interesting to maybe the children this way could actually see that they have a power to call anger a name and look at it and say, here's anger. Then already you're bigger than the anger. Of course, my children didn't have anything to do with the book, and it was only me that was reading it. So the other aspect, which is a very wise aspect of it, is not to, once we can hold it, we can see, yes, there is anger in me, and I really feel this is the major step, there is anger that's come up now, and it's here in me. That's the major step. There is sadness in me, I know it. It's here. It has in it the answer to this problem that people always say, emotions, they're not good to suppress, ladchik, but they also, there's a problem with expressing. And now people say, oh, it's good to express your emotions, it's good to let out your anger. And the result of that is a whole bunch of people that listen to this psychology that are letting out the anger over everywhere, over everyone, and thinking it's a virtue. And what actually happens is the more you let it out, it just makes room for its sons and daughters of anger to come up behind. And so the anger you let out just makes room for the next anger to come and do the same. So you end up being quite an angry person and thinking it's the right thing to do because your psychologist told you this. So there is a very wise teaching in the Dharma. There is a wise teaching not to feed negativity. Don't, like they have on the zoo, don't feed the tiger. Not to feed negative emotion, but not to suppress it. And there is a way between the two which is much wiser. And again, in the words of Krishnamurti, let it flower, let the emotion flower, but know it. Because the knowing of it is not suppressing it and not expressing it. It's between the two. It's just knowing it and letting it come. And in the knowing, it does tend to make it less powerful in a natural way, without suppressing it and saying, it's bad, it shouldn't be there, I must squash it down, people don't like my anger. It's not that. We don't need to think any of those things. Just to be with it, let it flower, and we will notice that it doesn't, it's not so powerful because we are a bigger container. We have already seen it. So it's not so dramatic and overwhelming. And if anybody feels that after all the emotion is still strong, too strong, and it needs to be expressed, and you need to go and shout, it's really all right, because you've done your job, you've done what you can do, you've looked at it and it's still too strong, go and shout. But it's not something that's going to happen overnight. But it does work, this way of being able to contain in mindfulness the power of anger that it comes up, or the power of grief, or the power of sadness, or the power of other emotions that come. And this is a teaching in life. This is not just a teaching in the meditation hall. This is something that in our life we can benefit from it. In our life we can practice it. It's just something that we just need to remember. There's a very nice story or a text about the Buddha who and his struggle with fear. And the text talks about his own life of spiritual practice. And he says, I don't have much fear, and the reason is that I developed the strong power of concentration, mindfulness, and love, metta, or caring for myself and the world, and morality, goodness, non-harming. And all of these qualities dramatically reduced the fear. The concentration, the attention, the goodness of heart, means no regrets and no mess in the mind. They reduced. But sometimes when I was in the middle of the forest, in right deep in the forest, in a place where there were spirits and ancient pagan altars and ancient sacred trees and sacrifices from past and ghosts, and I was meditating there, fear would come. And he said, so what I did is, whatever position I was in when fear found me, I stayed in that position until fear left me again. That's what he said. And it's an image of, okay, be there, stay as you are, don't react to it, don't feed it by getting into the loop of reacting from the fear. Just be as you are, the fear will come and the fear will go. And it's kind of allowing the fear but letting it pass. Just staying as you are, letting it pass away. Many kinds of things that oppress us, that sit on our shoulders, that block us, that those things that we want to transform, we want sometimes desperately to move in us, to change in us, these kind of patterns, in a similar way we can work in a very similar way to transform not only emotions, also patterns, also habits. Judgment, for example. We may feel that we're judging ourselves. I suppose if I ask in this room, I won't do it, but if I ask, put up your hands, how many people have thoughts of self-criticism and judgment? I mean, I don't think there'll be anybody without a hand up. Because it's just, you know, we try something, it doesn't work, we do, I know, three breaths only, and then I'm back to my stupid mind. No, we all do it. So self-judgment, for example, and it's the same kind of method. We hold it in our attention, we let it flower so that we can see it, we know what it is, we don't suppress it, we don't express it and get into it, we just hold it in our attention and we let it go. There is a quality of caring in this. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about caring for your anger. That means like a mother to a child, not fighting your negative sides, caring for them, not struggling against, not creating more conflict inside you, more guilt because you have bad emotions. It's just another layer that makes it more complicated to transform, to change. So there's a sense of bringing it close and caring for it, caring for our negative thing, caring for our negative patterns, seeing them, because otherwise we can't care for them, and then caring for them. There was a story that maybe many of you must have told this many times, so if you've heard it before, but it's a very nice story. I read it in a book about conflict transformation, and it's a dream of a woman who dreamt that she was running away from a really big demon, and she was running and she was running and she was running and she was running, and the demon was behind her, and she felt his breath, and he was big and he was thumping the ground behind her, and she was running and she was running, and through valleys and over hills and around corners and through forests and so on, and eventually she came to a dead end, tsuk, and she couldn't run anymore. And so she turned around very afraid and faced the demon that came racing up to her with big teeth and big eyes, and the demon stopped in front of her, and she said, what are you going to do to me now? And the demon looked at her and said, it's your dream, isn't it? We can contain our demons. We can, it's not exactly take responsibility. I don't like that word too much because it's kind of too Protestant, you know, Protestant. It's too guilty, like I must take responsibility for my problems. It's too much. It's not a very Dharma language either. But care for, yes. Contact, yes. connect with as part of me, yes, it's part of me, yeah, and I will contain it, I will hold it, I will care for it, I will, my demon is like a crying baby, I won't throw him away, I will hold it. It may be crying, like Simi said, maybe it's a guest in my house I don't want, but I invite it in. But when we invite these demons into our house, into our space, we invite them, they come from our mind and consciousness, they come from our past, they come from our conditioning, they come from what we've experienced, they come from the pains and disappointments and frustrations, they come from being hit as a child, they come from all kinds of things. And when we invite them in and hold them and they let them flower in the eye of our attention, we find that they also dissolve away, that nothing is there for very long. And that's the beauty of it, that things dissolve by themselves. We actually don't need to do an intensive kind of censorship, censura. We don't need to be the censor, because things dissolve and change by themselves. The anger will not be there for very long, and our task is to know it, is actually to see it. Because if we see the anger and see the not anger, just like we see the pain in the back and then we see the no pain in the hands, we are able to contain both, and there is a freedom. And so freedom from emotion is also being able to see that they go, they come and they go by themselves. And there's this story, this Zen story of the student that came to the teacher and said, please help me deal with my anger, I don't know how to deal with it. And the teacher says, so bring the anger and I'll deal with it. So the student says, yeah, but right this minute while I'm talking to you, I don't have anger. So the teacher says, so go home, wait till the next time, and then bring it here, and we'll deal with it. So the student said, well, you know that in the time it takes for me to go from my house to you, the anger will have gone. So the teacher said, so there you go. I mean, it comes and it goes when it wants. So that's the answer to your anger. Just know that it's coming and going when it wants to come and go. It's coming and going anyway. It doesn't even belong to you. It's come from all the things that have stuck to you, that you're, all the conditioning and all the influences and all the disappointment, it's come from the world. It belongs to the world. So, you know, there's your answer. So this way we drop, this way we deal with emotions is an example of the way in this tradition we deal with blocks, we deal with patterns that tie us or bind us, that we deal with issues that are problematic for us, we deal with, this is the model. This is the model. It's the way we drop our baggage. We can't drop our baggage because someone says, drop your bags. We drop our bags because we see that we are big enough to be able to do it, and we're all right without them. We have to see that we're okay, that we can pick them up and put them down and we're still fine. We're here. We're all right. In the spiritual path, the transformation, although we can do this kind of wisdom, that we can work with this kind of wisdom, we can't exactly design the results. It's very much like the skin of a snake. When the snake is ready, then the skin peels off, and then a new snake comes from underneath. So we can't design our experiences. We can't design, program our transformation. Things happen to some extent when they're ready to happen. Things are shown to us when they're ready to be shown. One person will here experience restlessness. That's the message that they are getting. That's the message of now. That's its time. If you listen to the message of restlessness, in the same way, letting it flower being big enough to contain it, holding it like a mother with a child, the same kind of way, it will give us its message. But the restlessness is the time for it. And we can't say, the other person over there has a tiredness as his or her a baggage. I want that one. I don't like my restlessness. I'd rather have tiredness. The time for restlessness in this person at this moment, that's its time. And tiredness in the other person, that's its time. And anger in that, that's its time. You work with what's arising in natural way. What's coming up, that's its time. And we can't plan this, just like we can't plan ourselves, really. So it's a question of peeling off layer after layer as it appears, like the skin of a snake peeled off layer after layer as it comes in a natural way. As we do this in the spiritual perspective, and just to kind of going touching the other foundations of mindfulness, states of mind, it's a third foundation, same kind of story. We contain them, we understand them. States of mind, the object of meditation, or the place where we are paying attention, is more subtle than emotions. States of mind can be dullness, can be clarity, can be quiet. We may be noticing these things, it's fine. It's also sort of a raw material, chomagelen. It's also there, but it's more subtle. And as it gets more subtle, also in the fourth foundation, there's a whole collection of objects of meditation. And they're called objects of mind or dharmas, which are, again, qualities of understanding that we come to. Again, they come up in their time, we contain them, we hold them, they pass by. Come up again, we hold them, they pass by. They're more subtle. So there is sense of gradations of subtlety or qualities. And as we get free and freer, we drop our burdens of angers and emotions and patterns and habits and things that hold us and things that choke us, we do find something which is a bit crazy but very true and very mysterious, that we were free all the time, that we never really were not free. And it's something about the quality of real transformation, that when we feel the freedom, we also feel that in a sense we never left it. And I've just got a quote from T.S. Eliot, who says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Okay, let's take a couple of minutes.